And we go on to Detmar Meurers. He's professor at the University of Tübingen of computational linguistics, and his field is especially second language acquisition and foreign language teaching. And he has now the talk. Okay. You need that? Yeah.
All right. Technology is working, I think. Thanks a lot for the invitation. I'm very happy to be here and talk about the connection of digital humanities and actually some of these issues that we saw coming up. How much do we do data-driven? How much do we do theory-driven? I myself, a computational linguist coming from linguistics, studied computer science and psychology later. And let me start and see if that works. No, it is. Okay, all right. So let me start with the guiding question of this section, because we're all under different sections, as you heard earlier today. And the guiding question for this section is digital humanities, what kind of knowledge can we expect? And I think one good starting point that actually also adds a bit to the earlier discussion is let's think about where we come from when we come from a humanities discipline. So in linguistics, what do we care about? Which aspects of language? Well, different ones, such as how language is acquired by individuals. We'll hear more about that language learning aspect. Then also how languages change over time, historical linguistics, and influence each other, language contact phenomena. Questions about how form and meaning interact in language as a system, kind of in generative linguistics, how does form and meaning, how is it paired with function, and how does all of that as a system work? And then also language use, how does language use correlate with questions of personal identity, culture, and all these kind of social linguistic concepts. Now, digital world, what does it provide us in addition? Why do we now talk about this connecting? What are we trying to connect? Well, the digital world provides increasingly large sets of data. We've heard about some of them earlier. Corpora are collected in different contexts, news, subtitles of TV. Learner corpora, we can suddenly document how learners learn, not just by a teacher looking at students, where you can perhaps monitor 20, 30 students, but the EF ChemDat database actually contains 76,000 learners of English. So you can study their learning in that database. And of course, also historical corpora, something easy to forget is that historical linguists were the original corpus linguists, of course, because they can't talk to their informants, they're dead. So the idea is you really need to also look at how to analyze data and ask the historical linguistic research questions. Now, first of all, one should say, as has been also mentioned earlier, that there are a lot of success stories. So while I will paint a couple of also kind of clouds into the sky in a minute, the increased size and representativeness of digital language data supports enormous insights into how language works, also based on the questions that I just mentioned earlier. Let me just give you one concrete example by Mark Brisbert and colleagues. They found that if you look at TV subtitles, which you can just freely download from the internet and create a large corpus, that the frequencies of the words in those subtitle corpora are actually by far the best predictors we have of the performance of humans when you test them for word processing abilities. For example, lexical decision task, is this word in a language or not? So if you look at frequencies, you get great predictions of human behavior when they interact with language. One interesting point here relating to the issue we had earlier about representativeness, or actually about size, is representativeness here. So he found in another work cited here that actually representative matters, not size as such. Sizes above 20 to 30 million don't pay off. You don't get better predictions. And actually, with 20 to 30 million subtitle words, you get much better predictions than with all the Google data, the Google Ngram data. So size isn't key, representativeness is. That's one take-home point here. But now also let's think about this. At the same time, the more data becomes available, the more simplistic our access of that data has become. So language often seems to be reduced to just the surface forms. Let's count the words. Is that all you want to do in linguistics? And let me show you a couple examples where it works, kind of. We've heard one before, statistical machine translation. We'll get back to that in a minute. But also, when you think about the educational sector, we just heard about earlier from Irina, then essay grading, grading student performance is an important task that is needed everywhere from high school to university. And already right now, there are commercial systems, a lot of them out there, that grade essays automatically based basically on a view of language as a bag of words. Just words, nothing more. There's no grammar, there's no meaning as such. All it is just a kind of highly dimensional vector of lexical occurrences. And it works. So we need to give that some credit. But at the same time, let's think about, I entitled this Steinbeck's Canary Row that some of you may know, or counting surface forms is fishy. Why? Well, because you put all this big data in Google to the test. How to can your own tuna fish? You know, it's about recipes and canning tuna. Guess what happens if you only count? Well, you get, wie können Sie Ihren eigenen Thunfisch, which is how to be able to your own tuna fish. So every linguist in the audience, and actually every student in the first class of linguistics that you ever find, will be able to tell you that parts of speech matter. And here you've got a main verb, to can tuna fish, to can, and you've got an auxiliary, to be able to. So we need more than just surface forms, we need underlying classes. We need to see more and use the knowledge that actually the disciplines have. And that's, I think, one important point that hopefully after this talk will join the discussion, that there were many interesting points in the earlier talk, but where can the experts still contribute? Where does our domain knowledge actually go is one question I want to ask here and add to the discussion. So that at that point, you could say, well, you can annotate corpora. That's what linguists can do. Instead of having the expertise, you put the expertise into the annotated data, and then you're done. Then we no longer need the experts. But now let's think about that. Is it that easy? Where do these linguistic categories come from? Is that just established? Do we know everything there already? We've got grammars, we've got Duden. Why do we do linguistics still, right? But where it comes from is that categories, we need to ask ourselves, what are the generalizations that we have here? And what are the observable properties in the data that we want to connect these categories with? So linguistic categories, the most traditional ones, they date back a long time to Latin and Greek. We've got cases, accusative, nominative. We've got parts of speech, nouns, verbs. And more recently, there's also other kind of categories. For example, sentiment. Do you like something? Do you not like something? They're not traditional linguistic categories. But you can, again, establish the annotation schemes, which kind of things do you want. And then the reference corpora, where you perform the manual annotation. And then you establish a new kind of label for different kinds of data. Now, let's take a look at parts of speech, because I think pretty much everyone will be familiar with it across the fields. But what you may not be able to recall immediately without me telling you is that really there are three sources of evidence for parts of speech. You can either just look it up in the dictionary, what we linguists call a lemma. I was surprised by the word of the day. You look up of, and you find, hey, it's a preposition. Just dictionary lookup. If you have, there's a lot of construction going on, you can also analyze what we call the suffix, ion, and that's a typical kind of noun suffix. So morphology also provides evidence. And then in the old man left, you can look at what's called distribution. Stuff to the left, stuff to the right. What's likely to appear between an adjective and a verb? Well, it's likely to be a noun, right? Okay, so here we have it. We know about the relevance of parts of speech, also from the Google example and other cases. And now we've established that it can be rooted in what we can find in corpora. The words, their morphology, and their distribution. Okay, now what happens if we naively just apply this to new data? We've got learner data. And as you heard, I'm kind of interested in language acquisition. And in an article, we looked at assigning parts of speech categories for learner data. Let's look at Red helped him during he was in prison. Oh, gee whiz, you know, I guess during, I look it up in the dictionary, I get out that it's a preposition, that's easy. But hey, distributionally, between at the slot where it is, it's more like while. Red helped him while he was in prison or something. And while is not a preposition. Or how about one of the favorite places to visit for many foreigners? Well, you know, you could say, well, we don't want to deal with that kind of data. But that's not really a choice, right? Data-driven research should deal with the data as it is and apply what we know about the discipline to gain new insights from the data. That's the idea. All right, so here we would have to say, well, lemma-wise, it's foreign, it's an adjective, but distribution-wise, and this little s there, plural, that's a noun. Or how about to be choiced for a job? So all of these are real learner sentences they wrote, Spanish speakers of English. And here, choice, well, it's a noun or adjective. It's a choice beefsteak, or I have no choice. But distribution-wise, in terms of morphology, ed as suffix, it's a typical verb. So what I hope I've shown you here is that if you go the route of, hey, let's use the knowledge, we know everything about language, now let's apply our labels to the new data, and then we can use it as insights, data-driven insights with our labels. That's not enough, because a single part of speech here that is from the standard established native text set fails to systematically characterize what is typical of learner language, namely the fact that you can have this dissociation of these things. Therefore, what's sometimes called robustness, when I'm hanging out with my compiling friends, they usually say, hey, I've got a robust parser, which means it can deal with any data that goes in. Well, but what is it going to do with it? Robustness means ignoring something that's in your data and saying, well, I saw choice, but I actually think I saw chosen, and I'm going to deal with it that way. Right? You're ignoring what's actually in the data. That's what robustness is. You're not taking the data for real. You're saying there's something else in there. Okay, and for learner language, that has often been called comparative fallacy, already in 83. So the mistake of studying the systematic character of one language by comparing it to another would be like saying, well, Hannover is almost like Tübingen, except that the train station is bigger. Well, am I doing justice to Hannover in that way? Well, not quite. Right? So the key thing is, try to characterize things in its own right, not as a comparison to a reference that you haven't even made explicit often. So this issue then is, of course, much more general. It's what happens when I go to the Amazon Delta and I look at these languages there and I say, let me study these languages of these indigenous people. And gee whiz, there's nominative, there's accusative, and a verb coming by and a noun. What am I doing? Well, I'm doing exactly this comparative fallacy. I'm taking my interpretive background and applying to the data, and I'm kind of not taking it at face value, but I'm seeing it through my pink glasses of, you know, a linguist trained with having studied Latin. So we need both. You can see that we don't want to take the data at face value, and we don't want to take the categories at face value. We need a connection between the two things. So, and this is, of course, for those in hermeneutics, it's not new at all. The interpretation of a text given a background then informs your background, on which, again, you interpret the text, and so on. But it's applying it now to this kind of digital humanities possibility of connecting large data to new research questions and old research questions that requires us, in this context here of language learning, to provide access to data through abstractions. The abstractions need to be relevant to a range of research questions, which then means we should annotate data with multiple types of annotation, depending on the research questions, at different levels of granularity, which you need, as you saw, for example, three parts of speech for learner language, but only one for native language. And you also need to, if you want robustness, you need to say, what are you robust about? As in the work of Anke Lüdling, for example, where she says, if you want to be data-driven, corpus-based, yet robust, then make sure to add the level that you're robust about as a target hypothesis, that the data that you're actually applying the label to is actually in the corpus, as opposed to just a hypothesis that is implicit behind the label that you're providing. Okay, but now you, of course, ask yourself, it's fine to say, for example, we heard about these great collections, artworks. Who is going to do the labeling? That's something that's an interesting question to me as a linguist, where I could say, I talk again computational linguistics or to my students, and we set up taggers, parsers, classifiers. We label data that works for a certain type of evidence. But for other things, I think an aspect that we could go into a bit more and what it means is crowdsourcing, because you could try to crowdsource linguistic annotation, but that requires one important step that I think is a defining characteristic of what digital humanities has to offer. It requires rethinking your expert knowledge and reformulating your expert knowledge as empirical tests that can actually be carried out by anyone. So it is a very kind of interesting democratization that has to happen of expert knowledge, where you ask yourself, how can I make accessible my distinctions and the tests I would apply for applying certain kind of labels to data to people who are not trained linguists, who haven't been sitting around in offices for years and years, right? And if you then look at how people do field work, how they actually go out into the field and find out about all these languages that are dying out every day, all these human languages that no longer we will have access to unless we document them, what do? They have the same problem. They want to document the relevant properties of these languages, but the relevant properties, how do you find them? Well, Judith Thunhauser's work, for example, shows how to design tests to actually that allow non-experts in the field, because how many formal semanticists do you have to send out to the Amazon River, right? Very limited, and they may find it too hot or something. So the idea is really that you need to be operationalizing and revisiting the notions you want operationalized in a way that is accessible to people who will actually be doing the documentation of the languages. Okay, so that means, as the first kind of summary here of the first part, the motivation part, digital humanities really is an opportunity in a sense, but not just because there's a lot of data, but really it is an opportunity because it allows us to revisit the underlying concepts and categories we use, to revise and fully operationalize them, which often hasn't happened. There was a school of psychology that was kind of introspective psychology, and they died out once there were two people arguing with one another and they couldn't agree on it, right? So the idea is the same happens in expert areas of linguistics where people agree on something even though they haven't actually made explicit what it is they're agreeing on. And then also this kind of take on digital humanities highlights the allows us to highlight the empirical value and explanatory potential of the different notions we have, because there's many competing takes, many different perspectives in linguistics, as in any field. Well, which ones can you actually compare them, and which ones are better? Which ones have more explanatory potential? And let me show you in the second part of the talk a bit what I mean about that. So, if we agree that we've got data, we've got categories, and we somehow want to link them and question which categories we have, and then we need to ask ourselves which of these possible things that we could operationalize is actually bringing us payback. Which one explains more things with the data, and which kind of category allows us to predict new behavior, and then we can test it in the future to see whether these predictions are actually true. Well, we've heard about machine learning. That's what machine learning is about. You can set up a classification experiment that allows us to quantify the impact of these different features, of these different observations. And in supervised machine learning, what I'm going to talk about in a minute, what you do is you study the record of the past, and now perhaps you get the reason I put this title of from studying the past to predicting the future, because what you do there is you observe things in a large corpus that's annotated by humans or automatically, partly automatically, and then you test the model predictions on future data, meaning data you haven't seen yet, so unseen data, the unseen test set. Okay, now the example I want to give you is one that I think is easy to understand because we're all, actually many of us here at least, are non-native speakers of English. So what do you need to do to identify my native language, given, in this case, not pronunciation, but non-native text? So you take text, and then you ask yourself, this text is in English, I can see it, but what is the native speaker, what is the native language of the person who wrote this text? Why is this interesting? Well, because it has long been studied, this kind of phenomenon. Transfer, we all know it exists, and it's here is the definition. Transfer is the influence resulting from similarities and differences between the target language that you're writing or speaking and any other language that has been previously acquired by you. So it includes other second languages you may have. It involves all aspects of language, so words, grammar, semantics, ways you present things in discourse. And the cool thing is also it's a core research topic in a humanities discipline, second language acquisition research. People who try to figure out how on earth are we able to acquire second languages, and how can we also help people better teach languages. So it's both basic research as well as applied. All right, so it is a task that's out there. How do we deal with it? We have two approaches here that I want to show you. One with a PhD student of mine, Sari Bick, and another with Julia Krivanek. One is data-driven, exactly as we heard earlier, let's go from the data up, and the other is let's go from the theory, what the linguist knows, down. Okay, data-driven. First, you need a corpus. There, fortunately, are a lot of corpora out there, International Corpus of Learner English by Sylvan and Granger and colleagues. In this case, argumentative essays written by higher, intermediate to advanced learners of English. And we're looking at a subcorpus of seven native languages, Bulgarian, Czech, French, Russian, Spanish, Chinese, and Japanese. Each of those essays is between 500,000 words long, and we're looking at 95 texts per language, which we're going to divide up into a training set that we look at and a test set. We trained a support vector machine, which is a particular kind of supervised machine learning technique. Don't worry about it. It's just the thing. It looks at past data and the labels and then tries to predict on new data which labels are appropriate. And we trained it on 70 texts, so 70 out of the 95 we used for training. And in those training texts, it's data-driven, so we only look at the data. We said, extract all the things that occur more than once. Because everything that occurs only once, it's not going to be a good feature to look for, because if it only occurs once, it's so unlikely to be relevant in predicting stuff in the future. So we then found 68,000 almost n-grams, which are sequences of words between 2 and 28 words long. And then we used these recurring n-grams as features and said, if it occurs in the text, it's a 1. If it doesn't occur, it's a 0. So every text now is represented as a long list of ones and zeros, 1 for it contains this n-gram, 0 it doesn't. Very data-driven, right? You just look at stuff that's in there. Okay, the results on the held-out test set is 87% accuracy. which is pretty good considering that the random baseline, meaning you guess, for seven classes would be 14%. And at the point that we did this, best result on that data set before was 73%. So we were happy. You know, computational linguists like to have good numbers. But at the same time, we asked ourselves, what does this really mean? What happens if we now abstract away from the words to more abstract things linguists care about? Does it help us or does it not? And as a control condition, what happens if we abstract away entirely from the words and just to stuff happening between a frame of words? Is it as good as what the linguist can do? So here is an example, 3 grams each, adjective it, environment, preposition with, family, adverb at. These are part of speech labels in between the concrete words, and with 4 grams, then there's more. So we always keep the words and just replace the stuff in the middle with parts of speech. And the non-linguistic abstraction, we just, the star here stands for actually dot star if it's a regular expression. So any sequence of characters in a word. So starting with each, one word plus it. So what do you think happened? We were happy. We found that linguistics pays off. You see that actually generalization, if you look at, let me see if I can point this, up here is what we had, 87.4. And up this 88.6 is what you get when you go to part of speech generalization. So you go more abstract. You lose information. But you actually gain in precision because it occurs more often. Right? The more precise it is what you look for, the less common it's going to occur. So that's a problem, and therefore it pays off sometimes to generalize, but not to lose the information entirely. You see, more wobbling on the screen. 86.3 is what you get when you drop the words entirely and don't go to parts of speech. All right, so that's good, success, but it's so hard to interpret what 68,000 features may tell you about transfer. These are just collections of words and parts of speech sequences, so what is it they're transferring? So we figured, we need to start at the other end also and see whether we can meet in the middle. We've gone up from the data a little bit, but now let's look the other way. So why are words bad? Well, they're kind of good because they connect forms and meaning, but that also makes them bad. Because depending on what the person wants to say, they're going to use different words, not just depending on which native language they speak. Right? So therefore, you need a high number of features, like 68,000, to be able to apply it to unseen data on different topics. Otherwise, if you've got chicken in your training n-gram and chicken is not what they talk about later, it's not going to work. Right? That's the idea. So the question then is, can we abstract away from the meaning to be expressed to choices within the linguistic system? Let's study where you have multiple ways to say the same thing, and variation social linguists know about that a lot. They study questions of identity by looking at different ways of expressing things in language. Do they use swear words or not? Which ones do they use? And what we looked at is alternations in the syntactic domain. So he gave the book to John, or he gave John the book, pretty much the same meaning, but it's two different forms of expressing it, and linguists like to call that dative alternation. It's syntax. It's different ways. You once select a PP with two or an NP. Okay, so here is the experiment that Julia Krivanek and I did. Binary classification now into native, non-native language. We use 720 documents evenly drawn from a Chinese-English portion of the ICL, this International Corpus of Learner English, and then native English essays from the Loch Ness Corpus. So it's just a binary task this time. And then we computed only 21 features. 21, actually it's 42 features because it's alternations. So either one or the other. The alternations which can be reliably identified automatically because we don't like to do things by hand. So that's about a fifth of Levine's alternations. And for each document now we encode. If they had a choice, say for example to say things with two, gave the book to John, or he gave John the book. Which one did they use? And we take the relative percentage of those choices for each alternation as the value that represents the document. Here is what you find when you quantitatively look at all the training data, and you find that, for example, locative preposition drop alternation, that's Levine's term, so that's the difference between Martha climbed up the mountain versus Martha climbed the mountain. You systematically have this possibility to slip in that little preposition or particle there. And what you find is that Chinese learners of English, they only use the particle 15% of the time. So if you look at the entire training set, and 85% of the time, this kind of construction occurs without the particle versus native English. Actually, they make a lot more use of that particle. So there, it seems to be on the good path. And here, dative alternation, guess what? Not distinctive. So some distinctions, some choices you make in the language are dependent on your native language, and other choices are not dependent on your native language. They may be dependent on, many other factors. Okay, so Then let's look at the results of the classification, and that's now an important step to see what we're doing. There's face value at this when we look at all the data, but now we look at each individual essay. How good is it to look for all these, you know, what is it, 500 words in an essay? How much can we predict? And it was disappointing. Why? Well, 63% classification accuracy for a 50% baseline, that's not much. What's the problem? Well, we know great things, but the things we know about don't occur in the data, right? Levine talks about 21 alternations. If one essay doesn't contain any or very few of them, and we look at the proportion of use of this or that, and it doesn't happen, our theory doesn't help us. So we need both. We need data-driven and theory-driven parts. And we wanted to, therefore, infuse what we call data-driven life into these theoretical alternations. And the way we did it is now we study for each verb all the different selection patterns it has, not just data of alternation or this, but let's take each verb where they have a choice. Let's look at which choices they have. Let's define the classes to consist of all the verbs that have the same choices. And then, guess what? It goes up over 10%. And with a bit of fiddling with bigger data, we even get it up into the 90% range. All right, that shows there's actually something out there that we can do. We can combine this expert knowledge-driven theory part with the data-driven side that comes from having the large corpora. And we also tried it out with morphological choices in the meantime, but what we'd really like to do would be to systematically explore the range of choices within the linguistic system and then, important part, go back to actually the theories about transfer. All of the work we should do, I think it's a crucial question to ask, how can we connect the data-driven insights back to the theoretical assumptions we have about transfer? When does it happen? Why does it happen? And so on. All right, so let me sum up. Large-scale digital data, on the one hand, it's great. We've heard some cool things about them earlier today, too. Provides opportunities for analyzing data, here language data, but also, that's a point I would like to add, a clear danger of only analyzing the surface, the stuff you happen to find in the data you're given access to, which means just counting words, for example. And, you know, coming back to that quote with firing the linguist, I think every time you let a linguist use Google Translate, he can make it break very quickly. And so there is a reason for that. Expert knowledge pays off. Linguists can see the future. Corpus linguists can only see the past. And so there is a question of how can we make use of that expert knowledge to actually make sensible predictions about the future. There is a need to preserve our genuine research questions in the humanities fields, and the interpretation of data should be informed by the classes and contexts that we know about in these expert, in the domains that we're experts in. Now, in terms of annotation, the point was that we need to support different types of research questions, so therefore we need multiple levels of annotation. Crowdsourcing is a very good opportunity to revisit and operationalize the categories we think we know about in our expert domains, but we need to revisit them, interpret them, and explicitly operationalize them. And then I think we should go for experimental tasks and ask ourselves, what is it we really know? How much predictive power does the traditionally acquired expert knowledge have in the data-driven domain? So let's quantitatively validate the conceptual advances in a way that supports qualitative analysis of the features that we use. So that means in terms of stepping back from linguistics, I think we can have it both ways, complementing the digital humanities occupation or sometimes preoccupation with surface-near exploration of large-scale data. We really increasingly have the opportunity to enrich the data with classes, structure, and context needed to address further additional research questions in the humanities. Thank you.